Do we know what's led to major changes at the state penitentiary in Sioux Falls? Today is Tuesday, July 20th. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, this is In the Moment. Last week, Governor Kristi Noem announced firings and suspensions at the state penitentiary and within the Department of Corrections. SDPB reporter Ariel Zients joins us later this hour to detail what's coming out of her investigation into complaints that led to the personnel moves. The South Dakota Governor's 9th Biennial Art Exhibition is currently at the Visual Arts Museum in Sioux Falls. We'll visit with their curator and a pair of artists who have their works included in the display. We're broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Steve Zwemkian for Lori Walsh, and you're in the moment.
For SDPB News, I'm Laura Johnson. South Dakota has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country. The number of unemployed is back to pre-pandemic levels with the May 2021 estimate of 12,900 people, which is 19,300 less than in May of 2020. Marsha Huttman is a secretary of the Department of Labor and Regulation. She says the pandemic had an impact, but the speculative data looks positive.
We have increased by 11,300 participants in the workforce, so that's good. That's showing that individuals are getting back into the workforce, maybe after a long absence or maybe a short term during the pandemic.
Huttman says much of the hard data about unemployment and workforce numbers coming out of the pandemic won't be available for roughly 6 months. The South Dakota Department of Game, Fish, and Parks is weighing how to proceed on beaver hunting in the Black Hills and the state. The idea for a hunting ban surfaced recently when the Game, Fish, and Parks Commission discussed a proposal to create a year-round beaver hunting season across the state, with hunting only allowed in portions of the Black Hills, not owned by the U.S. Forest Service, from November 1st to April 30th. Keith Fisk, the agency's program administrator, says he receives at least 500 beaver complaints each year. But Commissioner Travis Byes says the population has been greatly decreased in the Black Hills. Byes calls for a study of the beaver population, a suggestion that prompted the commission to table the proposal to its September meeting. The state of South Dakota closed out its fiscal year with a budget surplus of nearly $86 million. Revenues came in $62 million higher than legislators anticipated, while spending was down by about $24 million. That brings the state's reserves to more than $301 million. Governor Kristi Noem says the state's financial success comes from fiscal responsibility and a respect for freedom. The governor never ordered statewide business restrictions or mask requirements. Since March 6th of 2020, South Dakota has received approximately $11 billion in pandemic relief. That money went to state and local governments and individuals. As of July 16th, the state has spent approximately $1.05 billion of its federal COVID stimulus money. States have until the end of this year to report an initial federal COVID relief spending. South Dakota receives an additional $1.4 billion as part of its second round of stimulus funding. It has until the end of 2024 to spend the money. COVID-19 cases are trending upwards in some western South Dakota counties. Health officials say the upcoming Sturgis motorcycle rally poses a further risk to unvaccinated people. Dr. Shankar Kura is Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health in Rapid City. He says the rally provides places for the virus to spread.
Now, with the Sturgis rally, as much as it's outdoors, folks have to use the facilities for food, for drinks, for restroom breaks, and that's where the risk is the highest.
South Dakota experienced a spike in COVID-19 cases after last year's rally, before vaccines were available. Since then, 53% of South Dakotans 12 and older have been fully vaccinated. But in some West River counties, the percentage is much lower. The Sturgis Motorcycle Rally begins August 6th. Today's weather report shows highs in the lower to mid-90s across the state this afternoon, and tonight it'll be partly cloudy with lows in the mid-70s, with a chance of isolated thunderstorms in the west. Tomorrow, there'll be sunny skies with temperatures in the 90s. With SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson.
And I'm Steve Zwemke. Due to forecasts of continuing dry and warm conditions, continued drought, wildfires in South Dakota, and the high volume of visitors and land usage, Nebraska National Forests and Grasslands has announced Stage 1 fire restrictions beginning today. Ryan Cumbo is joining us. He's the acting NFG Zone Fire Management Officer. Ryan, thank you for taking a moment to talk about this.
Hello, and thanks for having me on.
You bet. First of all, Ryan, what are Stage 1 fire restrictions? Could you explain that classification?
So Stage 1 fire restrictions are things that visitors to the grassland normally can do. And so it puts in rules for visitors when they're visiting the national grasslands. In particular, this Stage 1 fire restrictions for the Buffalo Gap National Grasslands. So building or maintaining a campfire outside of a permanent metal or concrete fire pit is prohibited. Smoking, unless you're in a vehicle or an area that does not have any vegetation, will be prohibited. Operating a chainsaw without a spark arrestor. Welding or cutting and in an area that's void of vegetation will be prohibited. And then using any explosives, such as fireworks, that's prohibited on a year-round basis, rockets exploding targets. And so those are the restrictions that are prohibited on the Buffalo Gap National Grassland, which is part of the Nebraska National Forest and Grasslands unit.
Would that also include the discharging of a firearm?
That does not.
Okay.
We're still telling people to come out, have a good time on the grasslands. Shooting's a huge activity that occurs. Prey dog shooting, just target shooting in general. And later on this fall, we'll be having a lot of bird hunters.
What parts of South Dakota are included in the Stage 1 fire restrictions? If you could kind of give us a geographical look here, maybe the counties that are included.
Yep, you bet. So, this is the Buffalo Gap National Grassland is where these Stage 1 fire restrictions are occurring. And they're included in Fall River County, Custer County, Pennington County, and Jackson County. So this, again, is part of the Buffalo Gap National Grassland, which is all Forest Service managed. And so just in a nutshell, where this area located is from a line basically from Kadoka west to Wall. And if you can kind of triangulate up to Phillip, and then you continue over to south and east of Hermosa, down to the far extreme corner, a little bit southwest of or southeast of Ulrich, over to Igloo and up to Edgemont. So it's kind of this area kind of wraps around the Black Hills mm-hmm. all the way to Kadoka.
Yeah, so it is a fairly large area then.
Yes, and it's a little under 700,000 acres of Forest Service public land that this fire restriction comes into play.
We talked about the forecast of continuing dry and warm conditions, the drought that we've been under, and wildfires. Do we have wildfires currently burning in this area?
So right now there's nothing occurring at this time. The latest one was yesterday that was very close to the Wall Ranger District, which is part of the Buffalo Gap National Grasslands. This fire happened about 13 miles southwest of Wall. It started on private land. Our Forest Service units went down there to assist. We call it mutual aid. And, we have no problem doing that, helping out the neighbors, as we say. And last report, that fire was about 100 acres. And that's the most recent fire that has occurred. We haven't really had anything on the forests or on the grasslands recently, but there has been some in the past. Luckily, they've been very small. The fire departments have been getting on them real quick.
Sure. Obviously, some rain would help the situation and hopefully remedy it, not only for the grasslands, but also for our farmers. How long do these Stage 1 fire restrictions usually last? Can they last just a short period of time, or can they last for like the entire summer?
They could go either way, and what we use is a lot of data from our weather stations that are located on and off the National Forest System lands. And so we look at that data that's provided by the National Weather Service. We look at the Grassland Fire Danger Index, the predictions up to 90 days out. They have fire potential maps that say, hey, in the next 30 days, there's a high risk for fire. So we look at all that data. And then we also look at how many fires have been occurring in the area to kind of dictate that, hey, we probably should keep these restrictions in place, because we've had fires started by cutting. We've had fires started by a campfire. So yeah. Those are some things that we look into. And if we can get rid of them, you know, because of the conditions are good, that's great. That way we can get people to come back to the grasslands and do what they were doing before.
Yeah. One final question, Ryan. We're talking with Ryan Cumbo, the acting National Forest and Grasslands Zone Fire Management Officer. If you're in violation of these stage one restrictions, what could possibly happen?
One of the things that can happen, it's called a Class B misdemeanor. It's a fine of no more than $500 or $5,000 to an individual, or $10,000 for organizations, or you could be in prison for no more than 6 months. And that's the worst case scenario. And if you do start a fire due to these, you can also be held accountable for the fire suppression costs for these fires, if you start a fire.
Sure. Ryan Cumbo, again, is the Acting National Forests and Grasslands Zone Fire Management Officer. Ryan, thank you for sharing this information with us.
Yeah, not a problem. Thank you again.
Firings and suspensions have created waves within the South Dakota State Penitentiary and the Department of Corrections. But why? SDPB reporter Ariel Zients joins us after the break. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
When domestic violence occurs in a home, children are sometimes removed and placed into foster care.
When the abuse got bad, she called the police. But that's really where she came into the crosshairs of the Department of Children and Family Services.
Is that always safer for children? An investigation of the foster care system this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota, encouraging the development of artistic talent and appreciation in all South Dakotans. Advancing the arts through education, service, and advocacy. More at artssouthdakota.org.
SDPB's Fiddles and Friends returns this August with 3 live concerts. Enjoy music from talented fiddlers including Kenny Putnam, Tom Schaefer, and Owen DeYoung. Join us in Watertown on August 26th. Sioux Falls on August 27th or on August 28th in Rapid City. Help support SDPB and get your tickets today by going to sdpb.org/fiddles. Sponsored by Crisp Row Hospitality and First Bank and Trust.
Program funding by Sanford Underground Research Facility, advancing South Dakota's economy, creating jobs that support world-leading science, education, and our communities. More about America's Underground Research Laboratory at sanfordlab.org.
And welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Steve Zwemke in for Lori Walsh. An anonymous complaint by a prison worker has led to major changes at the state penitentiary and Jameson Annex in Sioux Falls. Governor Noem announced last week that she fired the warden and deputy warden after an investigation into a complaint. She also suspended the Secretary of Corrections and head of the Prisoner Work Program. SDPB's Ariel Zients has been speaking with current and former correction officers about the problems at the prison. Ariel, tell us who you spoke with and how you got in touch with them.
Sure. So when I saw this news, I put some posts out on social media that were shared asking to speak with current and former correction officers or COs, and the response was very surprising. I heard back from 15 people at least wanting to chat, and this is significant because it shows how upset people are. Workers are often afraid to speak with the media due to concerns about retaliation, you know, when they're specifically complaining about workplace conditions. And these people still were afraid, even though they did reach out. So I confirmed all of their identities, but most of them did not want their name being used over the air because of fear of retaliation for the current workers or even former ones who still work within the law enforcement field or still have to sometimes work with the prison.
So what did they have to say?
So one thing that stood out is, like, these weren't, like, disgruntled people who, you know, hated their job and hate the prison. They were nuanced, and they had they all had things they liked about working at the prison and being a CEO, and some were like very passionate about their job, but they said they needed to speak out because these were long-standing issues that haven't changed, or they've just evolved a bit. And they all keep in touch with, you know, they're either current workers or they keep in touch with current workers and they care about them. So the first person we'll hear from is Denise Callahan, who's a former CEO who, like I said, keeps in touch with people who still work at the pen.
They say that the safety issues have gotten worse and that benefits got slashed and they are not making what they should be making for everything that they're expected to do.
So what she means by that is, in terms of what they're expected to do, basically they're not being paid enough for the dangers of their job, but also they're not being paid enough in comparison to similar jobs. So compared to COs at jails in Sioux Falls or compared to COs at prisons in neighboring states. And we'll hear from another former CO about this pay issue.
I mean, if I can go there and make $18 an hour, then I'm going to possibly get assaulted, have urine or feces thrown at me and all that. I think I'd rather go work at Costco and make the same pay.
Another issue is staffing. And I received a document showing that shortly before the investigation was announced, the now fired warden announced mandatory overtime for everyone. And a source told me that the prison has even asked parole officers to work overtime within the prison. So the parole officers work for the DOC, but they're not typically working in the prison. But because of the shortage, they've been asked to do so. And a current CEO told me this is happening because the prison is short about 70 workers a day.
When you're being 70 officers short, you got to look at why are we so shorthanded? Why do people not want to stick around? People leaving is just, it's outrageous. You have a lot of people here that have been here less than 6 months. A lot of people stay less than 6 months and leave within that first 6 months to a year mark.
And this staffing is a morale issue that the sources say trickled down to the prisoners. Here is Denise again.
When you're working in a hostile environment, there's literally no chance of rehabilitation at all. You're not teaching them how to behave, and you're not modeling good behavior, and nothing changes. You're just releasing an angry inmate back into the world and expecting them to be good people.
Arielle, another big theme or focus of the complaint was safety. What did your sources have to say about that?
Like I said, staffing is a morale issue, but it's also a safety concern in terms of guard-to-prisoner ratios, but also being tired or burnt out. Another safety concern is workers skirting the rules. Two former COs told me that workers sometimes prematurely move prisoners to housing areas with more freedom to make it seem like the programs are working. And a former CO said this recently led to a prisoner stabbing a CO in the face. And she said she thought they might have died if another inmate hadn't intervened to help the CO. And then another former CEO said that workers in the mental health and solitary unit don't always keep an eye on, or they're ignoring items being passed around. And she said this resulted in an inmate using a pen to repeatedly stab her husband, who is also a CEO. And then a third safety concern is about equipment, and equipment in terms of equipment that they do not have but they want, so such as batons, or existing equipment that is old or cheap. And then also in terms of the supply amount. So a current CO said that there aren't enough safety vests and equipment belts to use when they need to transport prisoners outside of prison. So he said workers sometimes have to wear supplies that are too big or too small. And he says he's repeatedly told supervisors about this. And he once said, hey, there's only a left-handed belt and I'm right-handed. That would have meant if he needed to use his gun, he would have had to draw on with his left hand.
Honestly, when you're handling a firearm, that's not okay. That could be extremely dangerous.
And he says that even though he told that to his supervisor, the supervisor said, well, you've got to use it. And like I said, he says he's complained about this multiple times, and he's not the only one who talked about this issue of, you know, yes, you may make complaints, but there's no changes. They said that some workers also feel like there's no point in making these complaints in the first place because they feel leaders will just protect each other. And there's also an issue of leadership hiring or promoting their friends and family members. A former CEO said she hopes that this shakeup will fix these issues.
There's just a lot of like a good old boys club kind of feeling there. So it's good to see that this is getting broken up and not, and maybe they'll get a fresh set of eyes that see what's really going on.
And the current CEO I spoke with said that he thinks that external oversight or a union is needed to make sure leaders follow up on complaints.
Honestly, like, I don't want to throw the union word out there, but if any place really needed a union, it would be the penitentiary. I'm not a big pro-union guy. I never have been. But this place, there just needs to be some form of check in place.
So, Ariel, what is the Department of Corrections and the Governor Noem's office saying right now?
So I reached out to both, and they're both saying they are not talking. And what I really wanted to know, first of all, is the results of the third-party investigation going to be shared with the public? And then another question is about the scope. Is this going to look into concerns just from workers or also the impact on prisoners? And I ask this because, again, how Denise said she believes this is impacting prisoners as well. And then I had wanted to interview the acting DOC secretary and warden of the state pen to ask about these accusations from the people I spoke with and the complaint, and also what is your vision, what's your plan to change things? But again, they are not, neither office is talking right now.
Ariel Zients, this is very good work, and obviously there's a lot more to be found here as we continue coverage of this story.
Thank you.
When we come back on In the Moment, we'll be visiting with a curator from the Visual Arts Center, as well as two artists, as we discuss the South Dakota Governor's 9th Biennial Arts Exhibit. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I am pleased to announce that SDPB has been awarded 9 Regional Edward R. Murrow Awards for our reporting in 2020. Winning categories include writing, video, features, sports, investigative reporting, continuing coverage, and the Overall Excellence Award. Your support makes it possible. Thank you for your partnership as we tell South Dakota stories. Award-winning reporting is what you have come to expect and what we continue to strive for at SDPB.
Program funding by a co-op agreement with the U.S. Small Business Administration. If COVID-19 impacted your business, SDCEO Women's Business Center offers complimentary confidential advice. More at bhsu.edu/SDCEO.
Stay up to date with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Sign up for newsletters from SDPB. You can learn more about what's happening at our studios, get encapsulated news, see previews of specials, and so much more. SDPB in your inbox. Sign up online at sdpb.org.
Program funding by Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda in Rapid City, inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda. See you at Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda, Rapid City.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Steve Zwemke. The South Dakota Governor's 9th Biennial Art Exhibition displays 66 works of rigorously judged pieces that in some cases demonstrate perseverance in the face of a pandemic. The artists come from all walks of life, working in diverse mediums and styles. Art was created by those with full-time jobs, those with stay-at-home mandates, and those who have had their hours reduced or are looking for work. We're joined by Cody Henricks, a juror and curator of the Visual Arts Center in Sioux Falls, as well as two of the artists whose works are part of the exhibit, Liz Heron and Joe Schaefer. Cody, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Liz, welcome. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Joe, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have every... This is a fun group. I'm looking forward to the next few minutes we have to talk about this. It's a very remarkable display, Joe. And let me ask you as a juror how difficult it is to choose the pieces in this exhibit that help maintain the prestige that the biennial has.
So myself, the curator from the South Dakota Art Museum, Jody Lundgren, Denise DeBroy in Rapid City and Amy Phil in Vermilion get together. We spend about 6 hours in Precursor alone selecting the works. We get a huge swatch of images, no additional content. From there, our task is really to dilute down what it looks like to be making art in South Dakota over these last 2 years. From there, we get together, and then we go to war a little bit with each other about our discrepancies. But those 40 or 50 works right out of the gates, we really feel confident that we've selected things that represent South Dakota well.
And 40 or 50 come from a total of how many?
This year, several hundred.
Wow. So 40 or 50, and then as you were explaining earlier, you have kind of like a yes pile, a maybe pile, and a no pile. How do you fit in the maybes then? Is that where the war comes in between you and the other
jury? Yeah, that's the secret sauce of jury selection, which is everyone sort of has that agreeing point, and then there's taste that comes into play. And really where we have that discussion or real critical engagement with one another is, what do we think is valuable and what voices aren't being represented in the work we've already selected? So in that maybe pile, we kind of pick the ones that we really want to defend or works that, and then we have a critical engagement with one another. Where this year was via Skype for quite a long time, where we really went through that various discrepancy with one another about how to get through this thing.
Tell me what you're looking for as a juror. Art can be, so personal. As a juror, what are you looking for?
Well, I think as an academic, so my background is in academics, and I have a terminal degree in the field. I'm looking for quality work first. I'm looking for excellent ideas, well-crafted objects, well-made work. And then secondarily, I'm looking for voices that aren't necessarily represented in that work that falls under those well-made, critical, engaged objects. So if we go to a secondary look, it's maybe something that might be outside of the academia, or maybe we're looking for some outsider work or something that has a good essence of embodying South Dakota, because we really have a responsibility to curate South Dakota, not curate Cody Hendricks's taste, mm-hmm. right? So like trying to divorce ourselves necessarily from the idea that it's about us as curators and more that it's about a good representation of what's happening in this state.
Yeah. Once again, Liz Heron is with us as well, and you might know Liz from Fresh Produce and the Ipso Gallery. If you're in Sioux Falls, the Ipso Gallery, one of the places that houses art here in Sioux Falls. Liz, your piece is called Carbon Planet. Can you tell us more about that and kind of the inspiration?
Yeah. I think for about 2 years now, I've been doing these very abstracted terrains that converge with skies and bodies of water. But my whole probably impetus for making this body of work was that the paintings would be reversible, which means that they could be understood from more than one angle. And for me, that was really satisfying. That was difficult. And so it was satisfying to challenge myself to resolve a painting that could be understood as a landscape and sky, for example, in one direction, and then flipped upside down and understood as mm-hmm. a landscape and sky in another direction. Carbon Planet has a lot of darkness in it, I think, deep, dark values that kind of represent carbon in a very literal sense, and is maybe a little bit more on the environmental edge as I kind of start to move into that perspective, thinking about the planet as a fragile place.
All of the artists have different tools and styles that they use. What did you use to create Carbon Planet?
Well, I don't want to make my work less mystical, but I used acrylic paint and colored pencil. But some of the paint I used was really, really flat house paint because I like to completely eliminate any shine. And I'm learning all these techniques for reducing shine in paint and to make it absolutely flat. And for me, that's a texture or a surface quality that I really love.
We mentioned at the outset that all of the artists come from different walks. They had different circumstances as they prepared their work to present to the committee for the exhibit. Can you explain where you were coming from? Did you have plenty of time and to put thought into this and plenty of time to work on it?
No. I tried to find those pockets of time during the pandemic. Just like so many other people, I started teaching online or working at home and doing things online, for an art educator, that's very difficult. Mm-hmm. So to find time to carve out to actually paint was very hard. But when I wasn't teaching my child at home and I wasn't trying to do my job, there were pockets of time either in my own classroom or maybe in the studio where I could get down there. Last year, I wish I could say I was one of those artists that just found themselves with a lot of time to make. I found myself with a lot less time to create, but I was able to create a few pieces that I really loved, and they're continuing the train of thought that I was on before, so I feel like I'm making progress.
Is this your first piece to be in one of the biennials?
No, I think my first one was the very first biennial.
Oh, wow.
Or maybe the second, but it was quite a while ago.
Yeah. Joe Schaefer is also with us, and just meeting Joe this morning, a instructor at the University of Sioux Falls, and you're new there. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, I just got my first year under my belt. I'm the professor of graphic design and started during the pandemic. In fact, I was hired just before everything hit, so kind of got in the nick of time,
mm-hmm.
And then just sort of went quiet for a bit and waited patiently for the fall to roll around. I see a lot of commonalities with what Liz is saying in regards to the virtual teaching and having to sort of navigate that space and try to ensure that your students are getting the same level of quality education, you know, that was happening prior to the pandemic. But yeah, trying to find little nooks and areas when I could get down to the studio and keep making and sort of let loose on maybe some things that I have been grappling with mentally, or just, you know, some physical ways to make paintings, since I usually paint in a larger scale. And that's part of my process, is I enjoy the physicality of painting. So
mm-hmm. Let's look at your piece here. Friends in High Places is the name of the piece that you have in the Governor's Biennial. Tell us about the piece and the inspiration.
Sure. Most of my paintings are grounded in my design practice, actually. A lot of graphic designers, I think, would say they spend quite a few hours in front of the computer just clicking a mouse, sitting down usually. And a lot of the paintings are about sort of getting out of the computer. And like I had mentioned previously, intensity and immediacy and physicality are big parts of my painting process. It's about taking the tools and the principles of design that I know sort of inherently at this point as a designer and sort of using them more intuitively with various tools like ink, oil, acrylic, various tool brushes, and even sometimes, like in this painting, using my hands to paint as well. So the painting has a lot of textural qualities, much of which come from my actual hand.
Mm-hmm.
Moving paint around, building up impasto within it, building sort of depth through that process, and then playing around with the intuitive configuration that I create through the initial drawing that I put down.
You mentioned using your hands and how you made this painting. What did you use? We talked about acrylics with Liz. What were your tools?
Yeah, usually in all my paintings, you'll find sort of a black drawing, and that's usually an ink that I lay down first. And that intuitive drawing sort of creates the rules in some sense for the rest of the painting. And then everything after that becomes a bit more calculated. So the application of oil paint, spray paint, and various other media at times, sometimes collage, paper, mm-hmm. things like that.
I have an uncle that paints. He likes to paint like warbirds and sports paintings. And sometimes he'll walk away and it's like 10 years later, it's finished. So that's about as close as I am to painting. Liz, let me ask you and Joe, as a matter of fact, here. Let's can you walk away from your artwork and come back later and still have the same inspiration and still have it go in the same direction that you thought it would when you originated it?
I think it depends on the amount of time between, you know, when you leave your piece and when you return. For me, like, state of mind is always shifting according to my experience, my environment. Who I am at one time might be different a year later with the experiences that I've built. It doesn't mean I wouldn't carry the same kind of thoughts into it, but my life has changed in that time. So the work is inevitably shifting as your life changes, at least in my world as an artist, because I'm always thinking differently as I move forward with my art. So I would have to say maybe I couldn't do that, like your uncle.
How about you, Joe? Are you able to walk away and maintain that same inspiration?
Yeah, it depends. The way I work, sometimes I'll create, you know, I'll be working on multiple pieces at a time, and sometimes I'll just get burnt out on a piece. I'll just have to leave it and go away. Mm. So the time frame is, you know, anywhere from a year to like a week. It just depends. But after I make something, I'm continually finding new things in it just because I make the marks intuitively. And so I don't necessarily know exactly where they're coming from either. So even living with a few pieces here and there, I mean, I'll find something every once in a while because exactly like Liz said, we're always growing and we're sort of being informed by outlayers and exterior influences and we grow. It's the same way as if you go into any art museum. Mm-hmm. You know, you could see a body of work at one point and then come in 2 years later and they seem to be new pieces, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're not the same people that we were. And that's sort of the beauty of art. And so I think that my work will change over time as I change as well.
That's very cool. Cody Henricks, once again with us, the curator of the Visual Arts Center. And Cody, are there many rookies within this group of 66 artists that have pieces in the biennial?
I can't give you the exact statistics, but I do know that Joe's actually a first-time biennial participant. Our first biennial was 2003. Does that seem accurate?
Right.
Yep. 2003. So since 2003, we've had a lot of established artists who have continued to pursue it. I just met a young man named Dylan, who this was his first biennial. He's a young, fresh out of school. Amanda, who's on our publication, Amanda Berger, is an artist who's new to the biennial. So I think it is a good cross-section all the way to some folks maybe who like John Banasiak, who's I think been in every show in the state of South Dakota since South Dakota's founded.
Really?
John wouldn't say that.
Great guy. We had him on just a few months back. Cody, one last question before we run out of time here. Are any of the pieces of art available for purchase?
Yeah, so I think that's a really key piece, which is the biennial. The mission of the biennial is to support South Dakota art, one, to converge that west-east, you know, kind of collapse our chasm in the middle of our state, get everyone together, but also to support arts making. So every piece that's in the exhibition is available to be purchased. This Friday, you could come and check them out. We're at the museum. The museum will have an opening reception for this from 5 to 8. If you're interested in the work, you can always find it on our website. I would highly recommend supporting artists because they bring everything, they make everything better. So these two and everyone really in that show deserves the support of people who come out to see it.
I'm so glad we could all be together in the studio today. We had so much time away from the arts and the artists, so it's great to have you here. Liz Heron is an artist who has a work in the Governor's Biennial Exhibit, Joe Schaefer as well, and Cody Henricks, curator of the Visual Arts Center and a juror. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Let's take a moment and visit Lemon, South Dakota. Lemon boasts the world's largest petrified wood park, and it's home to the Kokomo Gallery, which is home to the unique sculptures of John Lopez. Meanwhile, the Grand River Museum displays a wealth of paleontology, including real fossils, and exhibits on Native American history, the Old West and the cowboys, immigrants, and others who made Lemon what it is today. Part of SDPB's Coming Home initiative involved a series of focus groups where participants were offered a small stipend to spend time talking about the places they call home. Many people talked about loving those places. Decades ago, kids growing up in Lemon thought the best way to succeed was to leave the town for good after graduation. Now many of them have come back, and they speak about Lemon's opportunities. Lemon was founded by Ed Lemon in 1907. It's a tale steeped in Western history when settlers and cowboys grazed their cattle there. But let's let Lemon resident Shane Penfield tell the story, and also his personal thoughts of his town.
I think we do have a very fascinating history in Lemon that hasn't been told, and here's why. Back in the turn of the century, South Dakota's history was essentially being written, and this area was being settled while our history was being written. So it was contemporary. It wasn't history yet. You know, there's not too many towns in South Dakota that can owe their existence to one single person, and we can. The town founder, George Edward Lemon, was a cattleman that was known throughout the United States at that time. He had friends in the Milwaukee Railroad in Chicago. He leased 869,000 acres of the Standing Rock Reservation, went to the White House, negotiated that contract with Theodore Roosevelt, came back with the stipulation that that all had to be fenced in. They were pushing west. They wanted the rail line to get to the Puget Sound and went through Aberdeen. They were south of Mobridge. They sent 18 survey crews to bring the railroad west, and not a single one of them could get it done. Dad Lemon, who we call our founder, was friends with the vice president of construction of the Milwaukee Road. They had a map laid out in Chicago. Dad Lemon, the cowboy, took a red pencil and drew a line of where the railroad ought to be. And when they constructed it, it was no more than 1/2 mile from his mark that he made in Chicago. Because of that, in honor of the assistance he gave to the Milwaukee Road, they named a town after him. But I will say that when I was growing up, it was abundantly clear, you need to get out of here. There's not a future here for you. There's not a way to make a living here for you. You need to leave. And that's why I ended up getting my college education. And I'm just so happy that that road led us back to Lemon. And what I think is encouraging today, when I talk to kids at the high school and I interview kids for scholarships, the message is not get out of here as fast as you can. It's there's opportunity here in Lemon for each and every one of you, and we'll make it happen if you really desire to do that.
When we come back, we'll visit the South Dakota Tractor Museum in Kimball, where preserving history means more than preserving tractors. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Robin Young. Survivors of Canada's boarding schools for forced assimilation of Indigenous kids testify about the horrors children saw in the church-run schools.
Many of our children who ran away during the winter froze to death.
We'll speak with the chief of Canada's 634 First Nations next time, here and now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by the South Dakota Humanities Council. Promoting reading for all ages with a 2021 Young Readers One book, Imagine Imahina, by Juan Felipe Herrera, featuring English and Spanish text. More at sdhumanities.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the reporter who's digging reopened the Jeffrey Epstein case. Long after Epstein had gotten off with lenient treatment following a sex trafficking probe, Julie K. Brown tracked down dozens of his victims. Her stories led to his arrest on new federal charges. He later died by suicide in prison. Brown's new book is called Perversion of Justice. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, 1 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by the museum and the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center and Pier. Now offering free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. Learn more by calling the Cultural Heritage Center or visit history.sd.gov.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Steve Zwemke in for Lori Walsh. Tractors aren't the only attraction at the South Dakota Tractor Museum in Kimball. Visitors will find other relics that also lend to the museum's ambition to preserve history and offer tourists a friendly place to stop along Interstate 90. Harold Bickner is on the South Dakota Tractor Museum's board of directors, and he joins us by phone. Harold, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you. Glad to have us on.
Yeah, thank you so much. How long do we go back to the origins of the South Dakota Tractor Museum, and who had the idea and got it on its feet?
Well, the origin began probably in 97, 98. They really started moving on it probably about 1999. My dad and Garnet Ashley got together, and Garnet had a whole collection of tractors that needed to be displayed, and they figured out a way to do it and went from there.
Yeah, that was what I was kind of wondering, whether it came from a collection. Now, tell me a little bit about the campus or the facility there. How many buildings and how many tractors do they house?
We have six buildings for storage of equipment and items, and then we have a country school and a blacksmith shop along with that. Mm-hmm. So there's a total of eight buildings.
Wow. And do you have some things that aren't on display that you actually want to get into a building?
Oh, yeah. We've got people that are always having people knocking on our door wanting to bring some item and stuff. And we've got, I think, 48 tractors in there now.
Wow.
Along with equipment that they pull. But, yeah, we've always got people wanting to bring us items, mostly small items right now. There's always a few big items and stuff. We got a couple tractors and we can't get in right now until we build again.
Now, you have tractors that go all the way back to horse-drawn, is that correct?
Well, just after horse-drawn, yeah, in the 20s. A lot of we got 48 tractors, and most of them come from the 20s and 30s era, along with equipment that they pulled.
Is there a tractor that's kind of like the main attraction or like the crown jewel of the museum?
Well, there's a couple of them out there. I mean, there's some old John Deere's that are good, but there's other brand ones, too. We've got IH, we've got Case. We've got a kind of a one that's kind of a unique one is the Thiemann, which is you bought a kit, and then you took a Ford car, and you took the transmission out of the car and the motor and stuff, put it in the kit, and you had a tractor.
Wow. You were telling me, too, there are some other attractions there, not just the tractors. Tell me more about the old schoolhouse or the one-room school that you have there.
That is the Balster School, B-A-L-S-T-E-R. It's the Balster School. It comes from up north of Kimball. It was a country school up there for years and years, and they picked it up and moved it to town. It's in really excellent shape, and we've got a couple of ladies there that used to teach country school, and they take care of it with pride, let me tell you.
Now, you have some old desks in there, too. Did some of the did they come from the old school?
Yeah, there's some old, some of them didn't come from that school. It's a collection of other schools along with it, with the building, you know. Some of the items came out of the old high school up here before they tore the old high school down. Built new, some items came out of there, some maps, and then, the old picture on the front of Lincoln, Washington, which was pretty common back in the day.
Right, right. Did I understand, too, there was like an old jail on the campus?
Yes, there's the old city jail there. It's in one of the buildings. Yeah, it's there. Another kind of unique item is we got the old casino ballroom that was here. There was a mirrored ball hung on there.
Huh.
And a local guy here bought that and had it all refurbished. We got that hanging in there now, too. That's pretty neat.
What about, we're talking about preserving history and kind of passing some of this on to future generations so they can see how people before us lived and how we lived, and how we farmed and went to school and things like that. Is there anything new that's to the display right now? Anything you've added recently?
Well, there's been a few things we've added on their line. We got, like I said, that mirrored ball, and then we got the projectors from the old movie theater. We brought them out there. We got the Herseth family lunch wagon, which is kind of neat. We brought that out there. Got a lot of small items, one guy's phone collection. He worked for the phone company for many years, and he had his old phone plus his equipment he used to work on phones and camera collection of old cameras. And there's a lot of neat stuff. Printing press that just came in not too long ago. Another guy's been working on advertising items. He's got a collection. Another guy brought a collection of license plates, a collection of South Dakota license plates. So.
It sounds like a really great stop for people traveling Interstate 90. One last question, Harold. The tractors you have of the 48, are any of those still operational?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, many of them are still operational.
Do you ever take them out?
I mean, it might take a couple hours to get them running, but they were all driven in there and parked. And some of them still go out on a regular basis and go to parades and stuff like that.
Interesting. Harold Bickner is with the South Dakota Tractor Museum in Kimball. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Harold, but open weekdays 9 to 5 and weekends 1 to 5?
Yeah, and once in a while we're open on Saturday mornings, too. Lately it's been open on Saturday mornings. We got some people who open on Saturday mornings, but not every Saturday. But
this summer going better than last summer, I imagine.
Oh, much better, yes.
Good for you.
Well, COVID was hard on us.
Yeah, Harold Bickner again with the South Dakota Tractor Museum. Harold, thank you for the visit.
Thank you.
Rebecca Cruz and Sarah Carlson of the South Dakota Arts Council are hosting a webinar this Thursday at 1 Central Noon Mountain to assist artists, performers, and ensembles with the application process for Touring Arts and Artists in Schools and Communities grants. Rebecca Cruz is Deputy Director of the South Dakota Arts Council, and she joins us with details. Hello, Rebecca. How are you?
Hey, Steve. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. Well, first of all, can you kind of tell me a little more about the program, just so listeners understand what's going on here?
Sure. We actually have two programs that artists can apply for right now to join our rosters, both for our touring arts program and for our teaching artists program, which is commonly known throughout South Dakota as Artists in Schools and Communities. So the Touring Arts Program is an opportunity for artists to make application to be placed on a roster and provided with grant funds, which they can then use to give discounted rates for performances and workshops all throughout the state to nonprofit organizations. For the Teaching Artist Roster, the Artists in Schools and Communities Program, this is an opportunity for artists who would like to be working in schools and other community settings for nonprofit organizations, teaching artist residencies throughout the year. Some of these residencies are a week in length. Some of them end up being a semester in length. And these kinds of residencies are held at all kinds of different organizations, arts centers, healthcare centers, veterans facilities, schools, and the like.
I'm wondering if you could maybe even focus in a little more closely here as to one of these residencies and what that might entail for the individual once they're on board.
Sure. Well, it depends on the artist and what they want to do during their residency program. So our current roster has artists who work in all arts disciplines. We have quite a few visual artists. If you go to our website and look at the list there, also some theater artists, literature artists. We don't have any dance artists right now. We do have some traditional artists who focus on traditional hoop dance, but no contemporary dance at the moment. But the roster is open to artists of any discipline who are interested in going in and teaching their craft to students of all ages. The residencies look quite different for every artist and for every site. So those are planned with the sponsoring organization, and there's a project director who works for that sponsoring organization and then works with the artist to plan those residency activities. Residencies are a minimum of 1 week, and artists are generally teaching about 20 hours during that week, and then the rest of the week is spent on planning and also on their own artistic expression, which they sort of demonstrate for the community and the students they're working with.
It sounds like it could be very fun, too. Now, the webinar is for the application process, is that right?
Right. So this webinar will assist artists in preparing their applications for both of these programs. They are separate programs and require separate applications, but we'll be explaining both of those and going over the materials necessary, and then just doing a Q&A for artists who want to ask questions about the program or specifically about their own applications.
Once you have the applications, what kind of things are you looking for in the process that follows?
So all of our applications go through a panel review process. Those panelists are made up of people from across the state and then also one out-of-state representative. These are all people with expertise in the arts and in arts education who will be reviewing applications. The panel will look at artistic work samples, resumes, biographies, artist statements, lesson plans for the teaching artist program, and then also support materials that show the artists have some experience either touring or teaching. We do invite all artists to apply, whether they're brand new to this or have been doing this kind of work for a long time. We strongly encourage artists in South Dakota, but we also do accept out-of-state applicants for these programs. Hmm. Once artists are on the roster, then the sponsor organizations can hire them to come and do this work.
Sure. Is there a maximum number as to how many new participants can be placed on the roster?
For the teaching artist roster for artists in schools and communities, there is not a maximum number. We do accept all artist applications, and we, you know, if there is a need for that type of artist, if their application package is really impressive and their lesson plans seem like something that are valuable for South Dakota organizations and something that South Dakota orgs are looking for, then we don't limit the capacity of that artist roster. Mm-hmm. For the touring arts program, there is a finite budget for the artist there. So some artists the grant amounts for that program vary greatly depending on the number of bookings that artists anticipate getting and their application package as well. So that one does have a limit, and it's based on the budget for that program.
Yeah, I had a question too about the touring artists and bookings. Now, is that something that they do on their own, or is there any assistance from the South Dakota Arts Council on that?
So at the Arts Council, what we do is we market the programs, but we don't market particular artists.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're sending out marketing material, it includes all of the artists on the roster. It is really valuable for artists to be out networking and making connections with people at nonprofit organizations to get their bookings set up throughout the year. Artists on the touring arts roster will be awarded 2-year grants. So on that program, the application only happens once every other year,
okay.
And the grant award is the same for the next 2 years. And then artists have the ability to go out and book all of their events and manage their own budgets through that.
I would imagine that there will be a high volume of applicants due to the pandemic, people that want to get out there and be involved and have their work displayed or whatnot.
We hope so. We would love to see, as many applications as possible come in. The Touring Arts Program and the Artists in Schools and Communities programs are both long-running programs at the Arts Council. We have some artists who have participated in them for a very long time and are really popular throughout the state and get booked up right away. But we also always have organizations saying, hey, we can't wait to see what new artists are added to the roster this year. So any artist who maybe is a little bit hesitant about knowing whether or not they're ready for this kind of work, we really encourage you to reach out to us, join our webinar.
Yeah, Rebecca, I have to interrupt. If you could very quickly tell people where they go to apply.
Go to our website, artscouncil.sd.gov. You'll find a link just a little bit down the page to the applicant portal and all of the information about the applications as well as our live assistance that we have throughout the next month is posted there.
Thank you. That's all for In the Moment.